The Truth About Radio, a WNEW inquiry. Tonight, a special edition with Red Barber, recorded 3 days ago in Washington, D.C. Interviewing Mr. Barber is WNEW reporter Stuart Klein.
Red Barber, it's a pleasure to have you before the microphones of WNEW.
Well, Stu, I'm very pleased, and I'd like very much if we could set the scene for your audience and let them know we're in the hotel room at the Shoreham on Thursday morning, and it's raining very hard outside. But if the rain lets up, the Yankees will play a doubleheader at Washington, and this will be the fulfillment and the termination of my present contract.
Red, this program is about radio in general and sportscasting in particular. But I think we'd be foolish if we hem and hawed around for 10 minutes without talking about your dismissal by the Yankees this week. If you don't mind, I'd like to get to that right off the bat.
Stu, I've had so many thoughts that it would take days if you just tried to dredge them up and say them. But they're always thoughts. The first thought I have is that I am tremendously proud of the work that I have done with the Yankees. I would not take back one inning of one ball game. And I am especially proud of the last 2 years, where with the ball club crumbling, I think that's the word, and not receiving the support from where it should have gotten leadership, I did everything I could and to try and make the broadcast as attractive as possible without in any way fooling with the play-by-play story. In other words, after all, the ball game is the ball game to be played. But between batters and between innings, if there was something I could come up with, I did. For example, I read the papers very carefully every morning and read the magazines, went to the ballpark even earlier, talked at length with people, tried to pick up things. Like, it rained here yesterday, but had it not rained yesterday, I have a whole thing of newspaper clippings. I have one, a description that came up in the Washington paper by a writer, Nicholas von Hoffman, in which he describes the new stadium here, D.C. Stadium, quote, the world's largest upside-down Tiffany chandelier. Well, I think that's pretty wonderful. Well, I was going to use that between two hitters yesterday. And I think the most important story that I would have worked on yesterday, as I say, trying to add a little extra dimension to the broadcast, was that yesterday was the anniversary, 25th anniversary, of the last man that hit 400, Ted Williams. He hit 406. And the last day of the season in 41 was September 28. And on that last day, he collected 6 hits. And when I saw that in the news yesterday morning, I tore it out and I said, well, I'll use it this afternoon. And I'll use that as a full fill between innings. And I was going to say something that I remembered, which is not in the in the news story. The news just merely said it's the anniversary, and he got 6 hits and wound up hitting 406 and was the last man in the major leagues to hit 406. Now we have trouble finding a fellow to hit 300. So it seems, to use Casey Stengel's favorite adjective, amazing that here's a fellow that hit 406, Ted Williams. Well, the thing that to me is the greatest dimension to that story is that his manager, Joe Cronin, who's now the American League president, Williams went into this last day, and he got a couple of hits, which got him to 400. And Cronin wanted to take him out. Said, now, Ted, you're hitting 400. Sit on it. And Williams proved the champion that he is, the great spirit that he is, when he said to his manager, no, I'm going up to the plate every time that comes up today, because even if I lose the 400, I don't want it unless I genuinely earn it. And instead of winding up sitting on 400 or 401 or 402, Williams risked being the last man to hit 400, which is a great pinnacle, and got the 6 hits and wound up hitting 406. So to me, that is such a wonderful achievement. This is the sort of thing I think that makes baseball important and makes it alive, that you have fellows like that. It's in the realm of the spirit when you encounter it.
I've read that this incidental material that you did, additional to the ball game, was not exactly appreciated by the Yankee front office. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. The word would come down in various forms and in various fashions and in various degrees of force. That we were talking too much, I think that was what it was said. And there were criticisms of these various things. But yet, still, there's only one way a man can do his work, and that is the way he sees it. Now, the thing about my association with the Yankees, I never once was under the illusion that I owned the ball club. The 9 years that I worked at CBS, I followed Ted Husing as director of sports. There was never any question in my mind what Mr. Paley owned CBS. I never owned it. I've always known, I've spent my life working for other people, working for my bread and butter. I tell you, the only thing my father gave me were the great gifts. He gave me talents, he gave me health, he gave me personality. And when I was 16 or 17, he gave me his greatest gift. He took me out on the front porch one afternoon. It was a clear day. And this was down in Central Florida at Sanford. And we stood on a porch, and he said, Walter, to his dying day, he never called me Red. He christened me Walter, and he respected me and called me Walter. And I would have been shocked if he'd called me anything but Walter. And he said, Walter, just look at this big world. Just look as far as your eyes will let you look. Do you see it? I said, yes, sir. He said, son, it's all yours. Go get it. And that has been my life. I've always worked for people. And I've always tried to be of more value to people than what they paid me. Otherwise, it's not a good arrangement. If a man paying you money can't make money on your services, it's not right. And I've been aware of this. So the Yankees have every right not to renew a contract. I've had no personal feelings. I haven't said anything about it. After all, if they came to their conclusions, and they haven't pointed any great finger of criticism at me or anything else. There hadn't been anything thrown back or forth. My position, simply, when Michael Burke told me, I think his phrase was, that the Yankees would not seek to renew my contract, I said, fine, I understand a coin has two sides. And we went on from there. There was no argument, no voice was raised, and I was just determined, however, that once the decision was made, and he had then taken such a positive position in my career, which I worked very hard for, and I'm very proud of, that I was not gonna temporize. I went, I had to get a medical appointment, and as soon as I finished that, I went straight to my agent's office, Bill McCaffrey, and I said to Bill, I said, I don't care who you call first or what you do, but I want you to start notifying the newspapers that the Yankees have dropped the black spot. And it's over.
Well, Red, exactly why were you fired?
I would leave that to you or to other people. As I said, there hadn't been anything thrown at me, nothing particular. The only thing that Burke said when I asked that question was, he said there was a feeling that maybe you were getting disinterested. And I said, no, I've never been more interested in my life. And that covers that right up to here.
Well, I have read that there had been some criticism of the Yankee broadcasting crew from Mr. Topping, the former owner of the Yankees, as early as early last year.
I said earlier that there had been varying degrees of criticism in varying forms and various strengths. Yes, I think Mr. Topping, from what I understand, was unhappy about the broadcasters in 1966. And now this is just a speculation on my part, but I would think he was unhappy about some other things too.
Well, what do you mean by that? The fact that the Yankees had fallen down to such a low state?
Wouldn't you think he would have been unhappy, Stuart?
Well, you certainly don't improve the ball club by hiring new announcers. At least I don't think you win ball games with announcers.
Well, Red Smith had a beautiful column which really touched me, and he hung it on the fact that Baltimore and had got the best broadcasting crew in the American League because they got out in first place at the start and they've never been out of it.
Well, Red, aside from the fact that you may have talked too much, according to various sources in the Yankee front office, do you think you were hypercritical of the team? Do you think that was your role in the press box to criticize the team that was paying your salary?
Stuart, are you saying that I criticized the team, that I was hypercritical, or is this something somebody has told you?
No, I'm just putting forth the question. Were you critical of the team?
Oh, now we come to it, and you're asking me now, you've changed it around. You're asking me if I was critical of the team. I was not critical of the team. I was not critical with any phase of its operation. Stuart, we all have to try and find out what our philosophy of work is. Now, I was struggling as a young broadcaster at the University of Florida. I was 4 years down there. I was trying to grasp this thing, and I was working at it as hard as I could. But I still was sort of drifting because I couldn't just sum it up in a sentence or in a paragraph just what it was I was supposed to be doing. In other words, I was trying to broadcast football games down in Florida and baseball games and recorded programs of operatic music and symphonic music. And on Saturday night, I was the MC of a hillbilly string band and sang the vocals for them. And I did whatever was to be done around that station, including sometimes sweeping it up in the morning if the janitor didn't show. And so, as I say, I was trying to find what I was doing. And when I went to Cincinnati, I was more or less led into more precise channels. I basically was doing baseball games. And yet I was still doing an all-round announcing assignment, but I still had not come to grips mentally or philosophically with what my job was. I hadn't had time to really sit down and think about it. And then it got pointed out to me very bluntly. I was suddenly summoned to go on the World Series, 1935. Chicago and Detroit, and that series opened in Detroit. And I was in Columbus, Ohio, getting ready for a football game. I had never dreamed I'd be on the World Series. And I got a long-distance call from John Clark, the general manager of WLW, and said, take the overnight train, go to Detroit, go to the Statler Hotel, and at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, go to the room of Judge K.M. Landis, who was the baseball commissioner, report to him. Boy, so in those days, you had four networks broadcasting the series. This was the first World Series that Mutual was on, and that's how I got to get on it. Mutual was suddenly put together for it. And so I went there, and there were all the great announcers I'd ever heard of.
For instance?
Graham McNamee was sitting over in one corner. Lowell Thomas was going to do color, and Bo Carter was going to do color. These were great newsmen, and people today just don't understand the impact of radio in 1935 and what a wonderful, full medium it was, and it still is today. The people in radio don't even respect their own medium anymore. I think too many of us sold out to TV because we got Fred. And I think also there's a younger generation now that doesn't know where this medium came from and understand the meaning of simple communication from one human being to another, such as we're having right now. But this room in the Statler Hotel in Detroit that day had all of the great people that I had ever heard about, and I had never met a one. So I sat back in a corner, and there was this slender old gentleman, Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, with his big shock of white hair, and he was a chain cigarette smoker, and also he had a right index finger that was all bone, and it was rigid as though it were a sword. And when he got exercised, which was consistently, and wanted to make a point, he would come right up to you and blow cigarette smoke in your face, and then he would stick you in the ribs with that finger, and he'd keep punching you. And it was almost like a reverse Harry Carey. And I'm not talking about the announcer in St. Louis either. I'll leave him to Joe Garagiola. But the judge, he wasn't saying anything to anybody, and everybody just kept coming in the room, and he looked at his watch, and finally he says, it is 10 o'clock, shut the door, and anybody who is not in is not going to get in.